Welcome back to the Dog Gone Wrong podcast, where myself and others share their mistakes and help you lift the guilt burden. I'm your host, Sarah Roper, the multi-dog maven. Today I have Nick Benger with me. He has a degree in canine behaviour and training, that's with the University of Hull, and is the host of Dog Talk with Nick Benger, the podcast. He is the expert dog trainer for Amazon's The Pack TV show. We met in 2019 at a pet business marketing conference, but I think we'd been in each other's circles before that. Nick shares his life with Onyx and more recently a baby puppy edition called Lupe, I think. Name's only just been confirmed. He runs Hound Plus over in the Bristol area. So I'm going to ask him in a second about the two dogs because they're not kind of normal breeding and I'm curious as well. So welcome, Nick. How are you?
I'm good. I do have four dogs, though, but I don't...
I'm sorry, I missed that. Right, tell us about the other two first, then.
It's because the other two dogs I have are, like, grumpy old men, so they just don't get as much attention on Facebook and social media. I have two little... I have, like, the complete opposite of Onyx and Lupe, so I have two little Chihuahua mixes called Pablo and Louie. So I really have, like... I have quite, like, either extremes of the spectrum, I guess, in terms of dogs.
Tell me first before we go into like mistakes and stuff like that. So explain a bit more about the breeding of the big guys, please.
Yeah, so I really got into like diversity. Like I think that like rabbit hole really started for me with the Pedigree Dogs Exposed documentary with Jemima Harrison. And then like really became very interested in that. And it ended up kind of just reading about that for years and years and years, you know, like more recently was reading the work of a lady called Carol Bouquet, who's a geneticist. Ka Heckman has a fantastic podcast called the Functional Dogs Podcast as well, Functional Breeding Collaborative. I can't remember which one the podcast is, but they also talk about this subject quite a lot. So it's just something I was very passionate about is like, I feel like there's a real need for genetic diversity in pedigree dogs. And it's a little bit of like a problem that is more apparent in some breeds than others, but it's certainly going to cause problems across the board. So when I decided that I wanted to get a bigger, sportier dog, I was looking for one that kind of had a similar ethos. And actually, I spent a lot of time on a website called workingdog.com, which is really very popular with people with Malinois and German Shepherds and stuff like that. And I was scrolling through there looking for breeders. And there was always like, you know, like favorite dogs I like. And then like after hours and hours and hours and hours, I always seem to favorite the dogs that belong to the same person, which belong to this guy called Hans Bodemeyer, who's a breeder in Germany. And he's very into genetic diversity and he's part of an outcrossing project that they have going on in Germany under a kennel club they call the RSV 2000, where you can phenotype dogs. So you can kind of say this dog doesn't have a pedigree, but looks like a German Shepherd, passes all the tests, then you can get that dog a pedigree and breed them. So it's a way of introducing more genetic diversity into the breed. And actually, this like program of phenotyping is like comes under the banner of the FCI. So actually, you can pretty much do this in every country. It's just that the RSV 2000 in Germany are very proactive about it. They're very passionate about genetic diversity, whereas it doesn't seem that hasn't really got to other countries yet. So then I ended up it's a long, long story really, but then I was again on a Facebook group and I saw someone post that they had had dogs from Hans. His name is Hans Bodemeyer. I can't remember if I said
he
that.
Did.
And so I sent them a message like, hey, what do you think of the dogs? And she was raving about them to me. Her name's Maria. So like that was, again, probably like a big selling point as well, because, you know, it was someone that wasn't, you know, I think everyone's going to say good things about their own dogs, aren't they? To hear from like a third party that they'd had good experiences was like another nice selling point. So I ended up going over there and getting my first dog from Hans, who was Onyx, who was really, for me, selected as like a pet dog. Like I wanted to kind of dabble in sports, but it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like a make or break thing for me. Like I just kind of wanted like a nice pet dog. And then I trained her have been training her now for almost 2 years. And along that process, I kind of got really hooked on a sport called IGP, which used to be called Schutzhund, which is a combination of three things, protection, obedience, and tracking. and became very, very interested in that and like a little bit hooked on it. And then decided like I wanted to get a dog that was a little bit more like bred with that in mind, like a little bit more talented to go far in the sports in terms of competition. So about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I drove over to Germany and picked up another one.
As you do. Add to the collection.
Hans gave me a call. Hans knew I wanted another dog, and he kind of called me up and was like, hey, I have a dog that I think is going to be like a really good fit. So yeah, that's what happened.
Fab. And so they're essentially classed as German Shepherds, but there's some genetic diversity and outcrossing in there as well.
Yeah, so they both have phenotype dogs in their history. So yeah, they have German Shepherd pedigrees, but they wouldn't be like 100% German Shepherd.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Interesting. I've kind of geeked out on genetics and the diversity within Daxies, obviously, because that's my main breed. And there is, I've been trying to think of a name while you've been chatting. There's an American geneticist who specializes in Daxies, and she's basically said that Daxies have the widest range of colours, coat types and coat patterns over all the different breeds. And she's written a few books as well, and I went to see her speak, I don't know, over a decade ago in London when she came over. And her stuff is absolutely fascinating. If it comes to me, I'll let you know. If not, I will send you a message so you can look into her as well, because obviously it's not just Daxies, it applies to all dogs as well. But yeah, interesting. Right, so let's get in. Sorry, go on.
Dachshunds aren't really, obviously they're not my breed, but actually I mentioned Jessica Heckman's podcast, the Functional Dog Collaborative podcast, or it's something like that, Functional Dog Podcast. She did a really interesting podcast on VDD,
mm-hmm.
and it was really interesting. And a lot of the breeds, like obviously Dachshunds are a big one that are susceptible to that,
yeah.
but it's not just Dachshunds, like there's a lot of breeds. That was really, really interesting. So you would love that podcast if you haven't checked it out.
I need to go find that one,
yeah.
definitely. Do need to go find that one. So thank you. That's a good tip. Okay, so what have been your biggest mistakes on your journey with dogs? Like, take me through it.
Yeah, like, I guess, I mean, you know, I've been training dogs for a long time, so I've made a lot of mistakes.
Yep.
More recent mistakes I've made with Onyx. I think, to be honest with you, any dog trainer, even when you've been training dogs for a long time, you're going to make mistakes. And you're going to think, oh, I wish I did this differently. I wish I did that differently. It always like makes me laugh, because I think that's what a lot of, you know, like you have the classic image of like, if you go to any kind of agility show, they've all got like 8 border collies, right? Like they just kind of get a little bit better each time at like raising dogs in the way that they want to. And obviously no one wants to make mistakes, but like, it's just part of the process.
Yep.
So the mistake I most recently made, or has been like on my mind a lot with Onyx, is regarding a concept that's kind of a little bit newer called neutrality, teaching dogs that there isn't value to be had in dogs or people, right? So these are really just noise in the environment. They're not like there's no expectation of going to play with other dogs or going and getting loads of attention from strangers. And if you can achieve this, it makes like everything a lot easier, because the distractions are a hell of a lot less distracting, because there's no history of reinforcement there. So when I got Onyx, the first 2 weeks, I was taking her to like a massively different environment. Like, she'd grown up in really rural Bavaria in Germany. And then I was bringing her into like the city in Bristol, and she was like a little bit nervous, you know, which is like to be expected. So I did what you think is the right thing as a dog trainer, and I socialized her a lot, because in my mind, like, this was the first dog I was having that was like a shepherd, and I really didn't want to have any reactivity. So I was like, okay, need to socialize this dog a lot. However, it like very quickly, like, we went from nervousness to like wanting to play. Didn't take, like, I almost did like too good of a job of that, you know, like then she just wants to play with other dogs. Specifically, it was more dogs than people, to be honest. And then, like, from speaking to people, a lot of people were like, no, you want to have neutrality, so you want to take her, you don't want her to be playing with other dogs, etc. So I did that. But the problem is, what I've kind of realized, because I've been through this recently, is there isn't actually really a lot of information on like how to do neutrality training, if you want to call it that. People just say, oh, just don't expose them to dogs or people. And it's like, well, that's not really the answer either. Like, you kind of need, like, to know, you need to have a system for what to do when you're out and about with the dog. Because if you just take them away from everything, you're kind of like going from one extreme to the other, and you're not really filling the void with anything. So you're not really actually doing any training or like progressing. You're just like stopping dog from getting the positive experiences from other dogs and people in that reinforcement history for the things you don't want. So yeah, that's been on my mind a lot recently, and kind of I feel like I've almost had to come up with my own like systems and answers. However, and I feel like this is just a theme in my own dog training journey, it's not like I've come up, it's not like this is like, I'm not like, this is not an original, like this isn't my original ideas. It's always like, I don't know how it just seems to be with my own dog training journey, that I'll just like, I'll come up with things on my own, I'll come to certain conclusions, and then other people will be like, oh yeah, we've been doing that for years, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, why didn't you tell me?
Because you weren't there yet.
It seems like there's a lot of stuff in dog training where it's like, it seems like by the time I've kind of figured it out, I realize other people have been doing it, but maybe not necessarily been talking about it very much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in dog training, we tend to talk about, there are a lot of things we don't really talk about very much. You know, like if you go to a pet dog trainer, they're going to talk loads about recall training, but actually like when it comes to off-leash control, like recall is actually just like a tiny part of that. You know, and even if you have a really good recall, it doesn't actually necessarily mean you're going to have really good off-leash control. I just find that an interesting, like, thing I've experienced.
Definitely. And I think when he was saying that, you know, everyone's, you think of something or you come to a conclusion, you start talking about it, and then everyone goes, yeah, we've been doing that, you know, since day dot, whatever. I also think part of that is, we may have heard it being spoken about earlier on, and not even this subject particularly, but we weren't listening. We weren't, because we've got this view of, we must go out and socialise the dog. We must make sure that they are exposed in a positive way and make sure they're having a good experience and they enjoy life and all of this. So we don't necessarily hear the opposing views because we're not ready to listen. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it's been some... think I've been on the other side of as well, you know, in terms of, I was having this conversation with a friend of mine recently because like now I'm converted. It's like trying to give that message to other people quickly enough is a real challenge.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like oftentimes by the time that you're able to get through to people, they've already messed it up, you know? With regards to neutrality, it's like something, I mean, not that you can't achieve it later on and there's training you can do and stuff, but life is a hell of a lot easier if you can get it right from the start. The problem is usually it takes people a while to kind of like come to like understand or like
at least
really
accept.
To get on board with it. And by the time they're on board with it, it's like those things are already going wrong and you're trying to like fix things.
Yeah, totally. I've got a puppy. She'll be 12 months next month. Foster from the Restart Project. Labrador, I've had her since about 12 weeks, and you know, I'm enjoying having a bigger dog in my life again. And obviously she's been set up to eventually become an assistance dog. That may not, you know, she may end up staying with me as the brood bitch. Oh dear, what a shame. But you know, obviously all her training has been geared up towards that. So when she was a tiny puppy, whether it's within the prison or outside, you know, I've been very much like, no, you can't fuss the dog. You can't approach the dog. But everyone, especially being a Labrador puppy, everyone is like, oh, you know, want to come and say hi to the dog and all of this. And, you know, when you go, sorry, you can't. And I am quite abrupt, if I'm really honest. People look quite offended of, what do you mean I can't, you know, it's their God-given right to come and touch this puppy because it's cute and everyone thinks they need to be socialised and need to meet people. And of course, they're happy to do that because it's a cute puppy and they feel good out of that. I've found that really, I mean, I've always been quite like, no, you can't touch the pup, or, you know, we can talk and then maybe you can say hello to the pup. But I saw it more so with Ada, the Labrador, and it's been quite hard to keep that up because some people just kind of, even if you sat at a pub and the dog is settled and happy, they'll just come up and touch the dog without you even being aware of it. And they're already touching the dog before you've kind of gone, can you step back, please? Even though you've got things on the lead that say do not approach, and or they're wearing jackets and all of this kind of stuff. Have you got any kind of thoughts on how to minimize, because I don't think it's ever going to go away, but any things to minimize that, or how do you cope with that?
I think, it's more difficult when you have a dog that is like of a stereotypically like friendly breed, or like that's the way that people tend to perceive them. I think it's always a little easier for me when I have the pointy-eared dogs. For example, especially with Onyx, now she's a little bit older. As soon as people see me, they're like staying away from me, which is like in the beginning takes some getting used to, but eventually you're really thankful of. It just makes life easier. But I mean, I'm still getting it with the current puppy, even though obviously he's a pointy-eared breed, but I still get people definitely doing exactly what you're saying. And I think you're right. I think the answer is you just have to be willing to say, hey, he's in training, can you ignore him now? Probably need to have something like that in your head before it happens, because you're not going to have time to think about what you're going to say. Also, just that if you're new to it, you're going to be uncomfortable with that kind of whole interaction. So if you have something to say in your head, then it's just going to make the whole thing go more smooth. And then you kind of have to give yourself permission to say it, because I think it does feel rude, but it's not rude. Like when you break it down, exactly like you said, Sarah, no one has a right to come up and touch your puppy in the same way they don't have a right to come and touch your child. It's crazy. It's like a very strange social dynamic. One of the things that I think makes it easier is like the story you tell yourself in the head, in your head. Like, for example, for me, no, I'm not training my dog as a police dog or something like that. Like in my head, it's like I could be raising a little police dog that needs to ignore people. For you, you were talking about raising an assistance dog. Like that, just having that story in your head makes you realize, I don't know, makes, I don't know, for me at least, it makes me a little bit more comfortable with like being saying that, right? Like you have a Labrador, you were talking about raising a Labrador puppy. You easily could be raising them as a guide dog, whatever. Like you, there are so many reasons that you might not want someone to touch your puppy that are totally legitimate. Even if you were just having a pet dog, it would still be totally legitimate. But sometimes just having that story in your head, I don't know why, for me, it just makes it a little bit like easier to feel like able to just say, don't touch my dog.
Yeah. I don't have a problem telling people that, but I know that a lot of people do. And I do say to people, have a, like what you've just said, have a script ready, practice it of, no, sorry, you can't touch the dog because, or she's in training or whatever it is. Because, like you say, in that moment, you're not gonna, unless you've got it ready and prepared, you're not gonna be able to get the words out because you won't be ready. But yeah, I mean, interesting how you say about pointy-eared dogs, at least. Yes, there's definitely with shepherds. We know that they have, people have these preconceived judgments of the breed. And but I suppose for the train you're going down, actually, it's working because it's working in your favour because people aren't going to be going, "Aye," and straight over the dog. How do you with? I mean, I love this. I love the neutrality. I saw that you were posting stuff about it online, and that was part of the reason why I was like, "Yeah, Nick's coming on the podcast. I'm going to invite him because this would be a great subject to speak about." So, do you have anything to counteract? So I know that a lot of people's arguments against neutrality would be, well, that's all well and good, I understand, but what about the time when a dog comes bouncing up to them off lead and scares them or whatever? How are they expected to cope with that if they've not had positive experiences with other dogs?
Yeah, it's not like they don't have positive experiences with other dogs. It's just more that you have a lot more control over it. So, I mean, for me personally, I still will socialize my dogs with like friends' dogs, family's dogs, but I just don't want them to have the expectation of greeting like random dogs park. I think actually dogs are like way more capable of dealing with that kind of situation than we give them credit for. Need to do like masses of interactions with other dogs, and you just tend to create problems if you do that. If you do lots, let's say you go about socialization in the stereotypical way, socializing your dog with loads of dogs, not only are you creating loads of positive experiences, which actually aren't that great, because then you're starting to cause problems with, okay, there is value to be had from interacting with dogs in the park, so it's like not the great thing that you think it is. But by meeting lots of random dogs that you don't know, you're also introducing way more opportunity for your dog to create a negative experience. How many times do you go to the park and people have their dogs off lead, and of course, you think the dog's going to be friendly because of the way they're acting, but actually they're not. Like, there's so many dogs in the park that are just, like, dicks. I don't know.
Yeah. They're rude.
I can't remember if we're allowed to swear or not.
Yeah, you are. You're fine. Carry on.
Why would I want my dog to have experiences with random dogs where, like, I don't even know that dog? Like, it could very easily go wrong, whereas I can actually have a much smaller set of experiences and be, like, way more sure that my dog's actually going to get positive experiences with dogs. Because I could be far more picky about who they actually interact with.
Yep. Yeah, I'm totally with you. I mean, for a number of years, I've been very much like, yeah, my dogs can speak to, interact with, maybe play with dogs that I know and I know well, you know, friends' dogs, things like that, in certain situations. I actively avoid public parks, if I'm really honest, because I'll end up shouting at someone. I know I will. And it doesn't end well. So I know my own limitations. When the dogs, I'm sure, would be fine. But I don't want to put myself in that situation where I just get frustrated. Because at the end of the day, it's about advocating for our dogs and ensuring that they feel safe. So constantly going into environments where I know I will get annoyed, angry, anxious, all of that kind of stuff is not going to help my dogs, at the very least.
People are worried about reactivity. In my experience through pet dog training, you kind of have two types of reactivity that you see most often, the frustration and the fear.
Mm-hmm.
Like, those are the two most common motivations, at least in our country anyway, mm-hmm. for reactivity. And, like, if you think about, like, well, what is frustration reactivity? It's like the unmet expectation of reinforcement, right? Like, that is what is frustration, essentially. And if your dog doesn't have expectation of reinforcement from other dogs, well, there isn't any, like, you know,
there's no frustration. There's no reactivity. I totally get you. I've worked with a lot of reactivity cases, and I'd say 80 to 90% of them frustration-based, not fear-based. Quite often, I mean, obviously, I get a lot of multi-dog households because that's me. And you do tend to get, the most common thing is, the frustration-based reactivity with the youngest or most recent addition in the household, because they've had the least individual time with the owner. They have the most time with other dogs that they live with. So they go on the park and they go, there's a dog, I get to speak to them all the time. What do you mean I'm on lead? What do you mean I get to go? Don't get to go and speak to them, bark, bark, bark.
Yeah, it's a big issue. Actually, for dachshunds, it's a really big issue as well.
Yes, I also get a lot of dachshunds, go figure.
You know, and when it comes to fear reactivity, is exactly what we spoke about in terms of the negative and positive experiences. You're way more in control of it if you're socializing the dog with dogs that you know. And also, you know, there is some fear to be had from feeling like they have to interact with dogs, or they're going to get dogs charging up to them, all of that kind of stuff. I feel like you build a stronger relationship as well for the same reason. Like, the dog feels like it's more, like, walks are more to do with you and them versus, like, looking for interaction in the environment. Yeah, so, yeah, I've definitely heavy into this. Like, I really feel like this has been a big learning curve for me. Like, I was conscious of it beforehand, but I didn't really know what it involved because, like I said, I feel like people were just talking about, like, oh, you need to do this, but they weren't really talking about, like, well, what do you actually need to do?
Yeah.
So, like, that's been a learning curve for me where I've had to kind of figure that out.
Okay. What would you say are your top three things that you've learned, like, action points of, you know, getting to that neutrality? What have you found?
The first thing is the thing we were just speaking about, like, how you actually go about socialization. Because if you get that right, like, that helps, like, significantly, you know, not actually letting them play with other dogs you don't know anyway, and focusing more on attention around you. But then also there's, like, skills that I think are really helpful, because you said, well, what if a dog runs up to me? Well, it helps significantly if you've already taught the dog the things that you want them to do. Like, unfortunately, in the world we live in, that is life. Like, people just don't have control of their dogs. So a little bit like we were talking about, hey, you need a script for dealing with people when they're coming up. You need, like, skills that you're going to apply in those situations. Like, for example, training the dog to come into the middle position. I really like off-leash healing. Like, that's been, like, a massive thing for me. Obviously, that starts off as on-leash healing, but the ability to a dog to heal and walk past another dog is, like, really cool.
Yeah, you like to show off with that one, I can tell.
And it's very helpful. Very helpful. Like, it's a little Yeah, it just makes life so much easier. If I see a dog coming towards me and I can say heel, dog runs round into the heel position, and then I can just walk past the dog. Like, that's so much more helpful. And then you can start like playing around with making things automatic. Like, actually, one of my favorite things to do when Onyx was young is walk down a cycle path near us. In the beginning, I had her on the long line, and then I started playing with teaching her that when she sees a bike, to immediately come back to me and come into the heel position. So in the beginning, of course, you're recalling the dog, you're telling the dog to go into heel, but then with some repetition, you get to the point where like they just see the bike and it's like run around to
And
heel.
that's the cue. It's an environmental cue for them.
Exactly.
Yeah, nice.
You work towards that becoming the cue, and then you can apply that to whatever distraction you want. You could do that with dogs. A lot of it comes down a little bit to personal preference, because it depends where you live. Like, do you live in the country where like you see dogs like hardly ever, or do you live in a city where like there's dogs everywhere? In terms of like what you actually want the dog to do. But like the ability to create environmental cues is like massive as well, and I think overlooked a lot. Like, even years ago, I was doing that. Like, I started realizing, this is like, I've been doing this for so long now, this isn't really a recent revelation for me, but like I realized, you know, there are so many dog, back when I was a dog walker, actually, we were talking about that a little bit before we started recording. There are dogs where maybe the owner takes them for the walk, and then every time they go into a certain field, they get the ball out and they start playing with the dog. And then you get to the point eventually where you've repeated that enough, where you go into the field and the dog's like, get a ball out, get a ball out. You know, like there's
It's
the
an environmental
expectation.
cue. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an environmental cue. So then I started playing about with that for engagement. So like I would have clients where it's like, oh, time of going to the park, the dog is like just looking for trouble. So you start doing things where it's like, okay, I go into the park. As soon as I go into the park, I start doing something with the dog, whatever it is that gets him going, like play with him for a few minutes, and then I leave again. And then we just start like deliberately creating that. So like deliberately gets to the point where I go in the park and the dog's like tuned
Let's
in.
play. Yeah.
Yeah, versus the expectation being I'm gonna go play with dogs, I'm gonna go raid picnics and all this kind of stuff. There are so many like little tricks like that that are incredibly helpful. This is the kind of stuff I'm talking about where like I had to figure this out, but I didn't invent it. Like, as soon as I started figuring all this shit out, like start talking to friends and like, oh yeah, I've been doing that. It's like, well, why is no one talking about this? When I go online, the only thing people are talking about is recall training. And it's like there's actually all this other like shit that just gets completely neglected and it's arguably more important. So, but like, yeah, I feel like me and probably a lot of other people have had to like crawl through a lot of glass to like figure that out. Where it's like, okay, well, let me save you some time and I'm just gonna make a course and put it all in there so you don't have to like crawl through as much glass as I've had to
No, that's great. I'm glad you're doing it.
and ruin a dog in the meantime. Not that
Yeah.
I've ruined her, but like you don't have to like, you know
You
what I
don't have
mean?
to
Like,
fix it. It ain't broke in the
yeah.
first place. Yeah.
Exactly. You don't have to fix things that you've then, because it's taken you years to figure something out. Where if you can just get it right from the start, it's like infinitely easier. So.
Definitely. I went through a very similar journey with Merlin, my flat coat retriever. I mean, he's been dead 5 years. So when I first, and he lived till 11, so it's a long time ago when he was a puppy. And I was just starting out as a dog walker. I wasn't a dog trainer when I first got him. And of course, I took him round. And being a flat coat retriever, very sociable naturally anyway. And I was like, well, I want something that will be sociable and can come out on all my walks with me and like everyone. And after having a people and dog aggressive dog previous to him, I wanted something easier. So I took him out with every dog, pretty much that I could, let him play with other puppies, did all of that, then moved areas, moved in with like more dogs, went from a pack of three to a pack of five, and then, realized how big of a mistake I'd made because I started on my journey towards being a dog trainer at this point, and Merlin was about 18 months. And I remember there was just one day where he just hell for leather ran off towards this chocolate Labrador on the horizon, and me being like, Merlin, as you do. And, this chocolate Labrador was not happy, and it had a go at him, and I'm trying to like puff, like run up behind him from miles away, so it takes quite a while. And the dog was not happy, had a go at him. I don't think any damage was done, but then Merlin responded with, "Okay, yeah, let's play." So at some point, that was really going to get him into trouble, and that was my massive wake up moment. And that took a lot of right, you're going to be apart from the other dogs in the house. You're going to go out for wees separately. We're going to make a point of playing together. We're going to go on the park. So you're not looking for other dogs, but you're looking at me. We're going to do loads of dummy training, you know, all things that were like specific to his breed, but just get that engagement. And then, you know, after I'd really put the work in, I'm not saying it was easy, I'd realised, you know, actually socialising him to anyone and everything had really not helped me. But, you know, from there, I learned moving forward. But I do find also it's a fine balance, but it also depends on the breed type as well. I mean, I get what you were saying about when you got Onyx, you know, obviously German Shepherd, we almost expect reactivity with the breed. Unfortunately, we do. So you were trying to counteract it, but in the meantime made other mistakes, which, you know, we all do. And like you said at the beginning, we're dog trainers, we go on this journey, we make lots of mistakes, but that's how we learn, as much as study and experience as well. Have you got anything else to add to neutrality and the learning journey there before we move on?
I was just going to say, because you were talking about making mistakes, like, it's not even really, like, you can't even really blame us or other people for making these mistakes, because this is just like the current narrative. And like, I feel like the mainstream hasn't really caught up on this. And we were doing what we were told, you know, like big organizations, like certainly it wasn't really that long ago, they had these socialization checklists. You know, you have all this information about, hey, your dog needs to meet 100 people. Like, this is like, this was in the mainstream, like really not long ago. All that was being pushed was socialize your dog with other dogs, with people as much as possible. And that's the solution. It's not really surprising that people like do what they've been told to do by people that they should be able to trust. Just a shame that the mainstream hasn't caught up enough with this. One, like, thing I think I've really focused on, just actually in life generally, but especially in dog training, is trying to pay attention to following the people that actually have the results that I want. So there's a, for example, with regards to dog training, I try to pay more attention now to people that I can see their dogs and I can see that they've achieved like what I want to achieve. Because I think there's a lot of people that talk the talk but don't necessarily walk the walk. And, you know, so when it comes to things like neutrality, etc., like if I see people arguing, like I want to see, like, if you're going to argue against it, okay, let's see your dogs though, right? Like, let's see how you manage a walk and vice versa. And I know the people, I've managed to, I have one unfair advantage, obviously, because I run my podcast as well, is that I just have a ridiculously good network. Like, my network is like ridiculous. Like, I'm just incredibly lucky in that regard. And so I get to talk to people that are really, really good. And I get to talk to people that I've seen their dogs in person. And like, it's unbelievable. And then I just ask those people loads of questions.
That is the great thing about running a podcast, I have to say. You get loads of free advice.
You're going to be in the same situation for sure. And so that's, it's just the most ridiculously unfair learning advantage that you could possibly have. So that's like where my thoughts are formulated from, is just talking to people that have really impressive dogs, impressive training. And over the years, I've become very conscious of just being a little bit cautious of people that like you don't see. You never see their dogs. You never see them actually training. And because there's a lot of people that are really good at presenting and they have lots of really like interesting and compelling sounding ideas, but they don't actually really have any evidence of like success. So that's something I've been really cautious of over the last few years. And also trying to like walk the walk. That's why I've been doing, since I got my newest puppy, I'm trying to post training every single day. And I know, because this already happened to me, I know I'm going to look back at it in a few years and think like, what the hell was I doing?
Yeah.
And I know this is going to happen to me because I look back at some of the stuff I was doing like 5 days ago and I was like, what the hell was I doing?
That's the joys of videoing yourself. Like within my membership, we do like little training calls. Like we're all on video. We all go and train for 5 minutes. We all mute. We're all like, we're not watching each other. We're just training. And then we come together and have a chat and we do rinse and repeat it 3 times on these turbo calls. But I also have like my camera or whatever set up separate from my phone and I video them. Sometimes I'll use the content and sometimes I won't. And I watch some of them back and I'm like, oh my God. What a shower of shit. Because I'm like, what the hell were you doing there? You know, you've missed that. You've you know, like, or you've timed that wrong. What are you trying to achieve? Especially when I look back through like previous months and stuff. And I'm like, for God's sake, but we don't grow unless we know what exact, like, we can see what we're doing. And I do think there's a lot of value in videoing yourself. And even, you know, people, like the people in my crew, a lot of them are starting out on, in dog sports and stuff like that. And I'm like, just video yourself, because you'll be able to see it. You'll be able to see where it's falling apart. And even the best of us still make mistakes. And it's okay, but make sure you're keeping a track of it of, okay, yeah, no, I won't do that again. But yeah, I know exactly what you mean, that you're going to look back in a couple of years and go, what the hell was I doing?
Yeah, it's already happening to me now, and I've only been doing it for like 2 weeks. But like, we should, I don't know what plan you've got, Sarah, but we should probably talk about dog sports a little bit, because that's been a big realization for me as well. Since, like I said, I got Onyx. When I got Onyx, I kind of just wanted like an active pet dog. I wanted to be able to try things, basically. Like, I wasn't like, oh, I need to do IGP. I was just like, I just want to get like a dog where I feel like I can do things with
Didn't
her.
Did you try bike jaw at some point? Or
no, I still do a little bit of bike jawing. Just, it's not like I've stopped doing that. It's just that was never the main thing. It's just like more of like a fun every now and then get on the bike, and it's just a good laugh. But like, so yeah, I tried lots of stuff. Like, I've done frisbee, I've done bike jawing, I've done IGP. I make this sound like I've been doing it, was doing it for a long time, but like, I went to events and stuff. Like, I did a Mondeo Ring event, so I tried some Mondeo Ring. Like, there's lots of stuff I've tried along the way. A scent detection. Like, to be honest, there's not much I haven't tried. You know?
Have you tried rally?
Yeah, we have. Okay. We run some rally classes in Bristol, actually. Yeah, nice. So done some rally as well. And it was IGP that was like, just that was the thing I got really hooked on. But I really recommend sport training, especially to pet dog trainers, because what I've realized over the last few years is sports training really fills the holes in our like dog trainer education system, like, perfectly. Yep. Everyone has the same complaint when it comes to doing qualifications in dog training. There's so much theory, so little practical, right? And I understand for the course providers, it's like hard to provide enough practical training. But dog sports like perfectly fills that hole, because it makes you have to train dogs very frequently. There's independent assessment if you start going into doing titles and stuff. And also, it's just immediately obvious if like what you're doing isn't working. Like, versus pet dog training, sometimes you can get a big head and actually not be very good, because you like don't actually have to be that good to like be much better than dog owners.
Yep.
So then you can like, but then if you only listen to dog owners telling you you're amazing, like, you start to think you're amazing, and then you do dog sports and you're like, oh my God, I'm so shit.
You come crashing down.
It's like a massive ego check. Yeah. And that's really uncomfortable. And I think that's part of the reason people don't want to do it, because they're like, I don't want that feeling of like being a newbie again, or like not being good enough. But if you genuinely want to get better, you just have to deal with that. Like, and you just have to deal with being crap for a while. And then eventually, like, you will get good, but you'll get genuinely good. So, yeah, I really encourage so many people now to do the dog sports thing.
Totally, totally. I think that as well, you touched on there of some pet dog trainers won't want to kind of embark on that journey because they don't want to be shit for a bit and don't want to look bad. But at the end of the day, that puts them in their clients' shoes. You know?
Yeah, definitely.
As in, you're a newbie, you're learning these skills, you're being taught these skills, and it makes you a lot more empathetic towards your clients, in my view. I mean, I think I started in dog sports in 2012, maybe, and a bit like you, dabbled in lots of things, was limited some ways because I was mainly with Daxies, but I had Springer and I had the Flatty as well, and did workshops in like, I mean, I done a weekend with Moira Rogerson on working trials, you know, did Heel Work to Music Day, I think down at the Dog Barn in Oxford, you know, like kind of really like just went, I'll try that until I found something that I wanted. And I was doing a bit of breed showing and then ended up migrating towards rally. And there's still more things that I'd love to try, and I'd love to go into working trials. I just need the right dog, because as much as I like to prove people wrong, it really isn't the right sport for a Daxi. You know, I've got to accept definitely defeat there, and obviously doing obedience. But I do think you're definitely onto something there with other dog trainers and also pet dog people, the way to growth with their bond with their dog and their skills is definitely doing dog sports. And, you know, I love teaching dog sports foundations, and obviously I teach rally quite regular, and I adore that side. And also you get more commitment and more, I think, focus from the people that you're teaching, because they're after the same goal. And when you're on that journey as well, you totally get them so much more.
Your point about empathy really resonates with me, because, you know, I remember when I first started getting into IGP, and as a pet dog trainer, the things that I'm training in terms of the luring and stuff like that, I've lured like thousands of dogs to do that thing a million times before. So it's like, if someone asks me, if in a class, if I have to lure something, like, it's just so second nature to me. It's like not a challenge. But then I remember when I started doing IGP and I had to teach heel work for the first time, it's like, it's a massive realization of like this, oh, this is what dog owners experience. Because my kind of mentor in IGP has been Alex Latto. Massively recommend him, a ridiculously good dog trainer. It makes me look absolutely terrible. And then, but when he was showing me the luring, it's like, I just couldn't make my hands go in the right position. And I realized that's what dog owners have the problem
with. It's like, you're a magician, I can't do this.
I see what you're doing, I just can't seem to do that. And then eventually you practice and you get better and better and better. But like, yeah, it was like a, definitely that was that moment for me as well. I had this exactly the same experience. And I know, I don't know if people might be listening to this and having the same objection I would have had. Because I remember when I didn't do dog sports, what I would have said to my, like, if I listened to this podcast, it's like, well, I have a pet Labrador. He's never going to do IGP. You know, like, he's not, like, I don't have a dog that suits this. But the great thing about dog sports is there is, like, pretty much always something. And you don't have to go to the highest level. Like, I could have done gun dog with that dog. And I really wish that I would have got more into that earlier. You know, like, there is always something you can do. And no one's saying you have to go to, like, a world championship. But like, just go and do something, you know, like go and get involved in something. And I think for a lot of dog trainers, because a lot of us get into it because we like dog training, it is like a remedy for burnout as well. It's like a vaccine for burnout. Like, it kind of makes you go, oh, like, this is why I like dog training.
Yep.
I forgot this. Like, I've been dealing with people for like the last couple of years and I haven't actually been doing a lot of this. It's like a reminder of like,
yeah.
Oh, wow. Like, yeah, I kind of like lost track of like, this is what I like doing.
Oh, totally. I came out of dog sports for about 4 years between 2019 and last year. And some of it was life, divorce, you know, like just COVID, like the rest of it. But I'd stopped. And last year, I kind of went, right, now's my time. I need to get back into it. And I'll be honest, I had been so lazy with my own dogs. Yeah, they'd go on walks. Training, they're all right, don't really need to train them, you know, it's not. And I'd been burning out, and then I started, well, part of it was I started my membership, started the crew, but, and obviously I had to start doing more, but it was also like there was things coming up, like trying out for the rally inter-regional team for Crufts, which I'd never done that side of rally before. I'd pretty much done every other role in rally that you could do, but not done that. And I was like, right, okay, I'm gonna get Ripple fit, I'm going to do my best for the tryouts. If we don't make it, we don't make it, but I know I've done my best, and I'm going to really kind of drill it and get her fitness up again. Like, dog sports fitness and pet dog fitness are very different, just for the listeners, and obviously me getting back into it. And oh my god, it was like a light bulb went off in my head, because it was totally like, I'm enjoying this, I'm not dreading this, I'm not going, oh, for god's sake, I've got to train my dogs. It's yes, let's go and train my dogs. To the point where I majorly geeked out and ended up like really breaking a behavior down and videoing everything with one of the dogs at the beginning of this year. So yeah, it is. I love that. It's a vaccine for burnout. I'm going to steal that. Sorry.
Yeah, no, of course. I probably stole it from someone. I've just forgotten. It's I know it's really, really good. And it is very rewarding. Like I said, you kind of have to like it sucks at first, but like, when you get to the point where your dog can do some cool stuff, you start feeling very good.
Yes. Yes, definitely. It boosts the ego, let's face it.
Well, at first it destroys your ego because you realize how crap you are. But then when you get to a certain point where like your dog actually starts like improving and like doing pretty cool stuff, it's like, then it's then you start feeling good, and then you know probably something else will knock you down. But that's just like that's just anything, you know. I think I really recommend it anyway to anyone. Get into something, you know. It's yeah it's really worth doing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've got clients and things that are just going to classes, as in dog sports classes. They've got no plan of ever competing. I mean, we know how that usually ends in time, but they've got no plan of competing. They're just enjoying doing something else with their dog, but they're bond with their dog, and they are starting to use some of the skills they're learning for dog sports out on walks, because they're like, oh, well, I can. And then they're like, oh, well, my dog ignores other dogs now because I'm asking them to do middle, or I'm asking them to do this, or focus on me, or do a bit of heel work. And it's like, yeah, it does fill in those gaps, and it feels good. It's self-rewarding as much as anything else. And that's, yeah, I definitely see why I've ended up going more and more into dog sports. And, you know, particularly I've got Daxies primarily. So that started for me a bit of a, well, I'm going to show everyone, because everyone used to say you can't train a Daxie. So I kind of went out there and went, watch me.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's interesting. Like, it's interesting. Yeah, we should talk about that some more at some point. Dachshunds have got so popular, you know, in our pet dog training business. We're seeing so many of them almost
and
always.
Most of them barky little shits, I can imagine.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to say.
Well, you can. Like, you can. It's fine. I'm not offended.
The problem with any of these popular breeds, just Dachshunds, is oftentimes people don't realize what it is that they're getting. They just see the cute little dog, and then they don't, like, do any research. So obviously Dachshunds, you know, bred to be vocal dogs, but people don't, like, know that. And then they get a Dachshund, and then they're really surprised how loud they are. But also, unfortunately, I don't know what your experiences are, Sarah. I think sometimes these issues can be localized, but like for us, we see lots of very fearful smooth coats.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is maybe just like a victim of their own popularity issue. But oftentimes it's not just like Dachshund barking. It's also compounded by the fact that the dog actually has fear issues. And so we're trying to like resolve the dog's just general nervousness.
Yep.
Yeah, well.
Totally.
And also, actually, for Dachshunds, neutrality is going to be really important, especially with other dogs, because whenever you have small dogs, they're so susceptible to bad experiences with well-meaning bigger dogs. Mm-hmm. They just bounce on them, wanting to play, and you know it doesn't take many of those interactions for you to actually like very quickly accumulate negative experiences and then end up with fear reactivity. So neutrality, especially for breeds like Dachshunds, is going to be like very, very helpful.
Totally. I think you said about Mini Smooths, how they're kind of a victim of their own success. I think that is part of it, yes. But in my experience, opinion, view, you quite often, well, one, yes, you end up with the less good breeders because they're popular. So they haven't had that early, a positive early rearing experience. And bred from parents who may not have great temperaments, blah, 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 which is the same in any popular breed. People jump on the bandwagon, don't actually put much thought or care into it, and you end up with awful temperaments. But it's also the fact that a lot of, even like show breeders and things like that, they will have a lot of dogs in that household because they're small. They won't let the puppies go until they're about 12 weeks. And we know that, you know, the socialization period ends around then. I would actually, having had many Daxies over the years from puppies, I would say it's probably a little bit under 12 weeks for Daxies. That, you know, and what have they been exposed to? Lots of barking of other dogs, and not the world. So, of course, they're going to come out from that environment pre-programmed to bark more than what they would if it was just a smaller household. But then also the fact that they're now fearful because they're in their next socialization period, which isn't as powerful, and not being exposed to everything. That tends to be where a lot of it comes from. But Mini Smooths, no offence to the listeners, they do have the worst temperament of all six varieties of
Yeah, that's pretty much been my experience as well, to be honest, yeah. Like locally to us. You said that a lot of the show breeders aren't letting them go to 12 weeks. Why is that?
Because they think they're too small.
It's interesting. Like, as in that they're just susceptible to, like...
disease. They're also paranoid about... things like parvo and things like that. When personally, you know, like I've had quite a few of my Daxies at 7.5 weeks. Yep, shoot me now, not been 8 weeks. And In fact, out of the three Daxes I've currently got, the three generations, two of them had half a parvovac at 16 weeks, having had no other vaccinations at all in their lifetime, and Mizzle has had no vaccinations. Full stop. That's my choice. I'm not advising other people do that. I've made my own educated guess, but, and they've been everywhere, they've been to Crufts, they've been and done everything, but for me, it's a lot of the breeders kind of go, oh no, they can't go anywhere until they're fully vaccinated, which some comes from the vets as well. But I've dealt with more dogs and Daxies, but dogs in general, that have not had the exposure. I want to say socialization, but I think relevant to this podcast, the correct exposure to the world within that initial socialization period, then I do hear or see dogs that have suffered with parvo or the other vaccinated diseases. And to me, I've made that calculated risk of I'd rather get my dog out from day one and let them experience the world. That doesn't mean they need to meet lots of people and lots of dogs, but they need to experience what happens in life outside of four walls to be able to have a life. And I'd rather take that risk of them then developing parvo. That's me. I'd rather do the exposure and risk that than the other way around. I know that if everyone did that, you'd argue, well, they'd all end up with parvo because no one's vaccinated. I understand that. That's just my personal choice. And I was actually earlier on when we started this podcast going to start asking you about your protocol for pre-vaccinations with your guys. But before we go into that, do you have any thoughts on the parvo or diseases versus exposure?
I think this is just a debate that's going to go on forever, to be honest, because I have two different lenses to look at it from. You know, if you have the veterinary lens where you're trying to minimize disease spread, then you're going to fall on the side of like caution. And if you have the training side where you're trying to get the best socialization for the dog, reduce things like behavioral euthanasia later on, then you're going to fall on the side of socialization. So it's tough.
And both,
because
sorry to interrupt you, but obviously the vets are going to see more cases of parvo and the trainers are going to see more cases of. So I understand the bias there, totally. Sorry, go on.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it's what you said. People have to come up. People have to be okay with their own level of risk. Although I do think that there are veterinary associations that are a little bit more progressive with this. Like, I looked into this for our own puppy classes because I wanted to see what the guidelines were for like when puppies can come to puppy class, because obviously you have this whole issue of vaccinations. And even though it seems like a lot of people are still waiting until they've had the second vac, and then the vet tells them, hey, you need to wait another week after they've had the second vac before they can come to do anything, right? World Small Animal Veterinary Association, in their guidelines, say that puppies can come to puppy classes from one vaccination. They actually did a study on this where they did exactly that. They just took a load of puppies that had only had one vaccination, started putting them through puppy classes, and then measured like risk of disease and stuff like that. And it like was very clear that the risk of disease was like minimal. So their guidelines are based on that. And that's the guidelines that we go by in our local business. So we will have puppies from in puppy class from one vaccination. Puppy class is like classic venue. So it's just like church halls, stuff like that. So it's not like we're in a park or something, you know. Then obviously, like, understanding a little bit about how the diseases are spread also helps you to make decisions. So for example, like a lot of the diseases are spread through like the feces of other dogs. Or like if you're worried about leptospirosis, like rats weeing in water and stuff like that. So when you kind of know this stuff, you can also factor that into like the risk level or assessing risk level. You know, like if you're taking your puppy somewhere where there aren't going to be other dogs, or like much risk of them coming across dog feces, or places where rats have, you know, like bodies of water and stuff like that, then you can factor that into your risk. Because I genuinely do have puppy owners coming to classes and saying, oh, I haven't let my dog into the garden. And it's like,
yeah, that crazy. That gets me. That really gets me. I'm like, get it house training, get it outside.
Like, yeah, you know, it's just a little bit more knowledge, I think, goes a long way with that. But also, I think it's probably going to be a personal preference thing. So I don't tend to, I don't know. Also, I think one thing I've realized over the last few years is genetics is like so much more important than anything else. And I've actually tell a story. Like, I've got a little dachshund client comes to our classes and started off doing one-to-one training. The dachshund had not been outside at all for something like 6 months. First 6 months in life, had giardia. It broke its leg. So for a whole bunch of reasons, I'm thinking it might have even been longer than 6 months actually. But like, there was a massive portion of its life it wasn't even allowed outside. It's the most confident little dachshund I've probably ever met in my life. On paper, you'd be like, oh my God, this is going to be terrible, right?
Yep, that's what I was thinking.
But this is where I think genetics matters, so much. And I've just seen a lot of that more recently. I think the genetics can help you just so much more than people give it credit for. And this is like why you should put a lot of time into going to like a good breeder, right? Because it makes so much difference. You asked me what I actually do with my own dog's pre-vaccinations. Oh, I actually haven't dealt with that because
No, of course not, because they've been from abroad.
I've got both of my recent dogs from Germany. Fortunately, for legal reasons, you can't even pick them up till 15 weeks. So I kind of have the flip side of it where maybe people would think, hey, I've got to do a lot of catch up. I'm getting this dog at 15 weeks, but the breeder is fantastic. I know they have very good genetics. And also, I know the importance of neutrality. So, like, I think that's maybe the mistake I made on the first one. It's like, oh shit, I've got to catch up loads. Like, no, you don't. Like, no, don't fall into that trap. Like, yes, you need to do socialization, but like, don't panic because, like, start, sacrificing quality for quantity. So,
Definitely.
these are lessons learned, you know?
And I am totally with you on the genetic side. I've seen it in many different ways, especially with dogs, through my own, breeding my own line and knowing other dogs that are passing on genes. And, even just some things like I actually posted it on my personal profile the other day, a video from years ago, which was Moss. Moss is my eldest, Daxie. He's just turned 13. And his mum, I obviously bred his mum to get him and lost her in that process. So the pups never met mum and I hand-reared the lot of them. However, there is a behaviour that is still there between mother and son. And it's just something silly as scratching at the door and licking the pane to make it clean and then scratching at it again, which I found hilarious when Jazz used to do it. It's rather annoying now, 13 years down the line. But Moss did it when there was no imprinting, there was no, this is what we do. He didn't learn that behavior. It was in there. I mean, I know that's like just very anecdotal, but it's amazing just how much genetics can influence so much health, temperament, just everything. And I'm sure me and you could actually deep dive on genetics at some point because I've, that's one of my things. And looking into breeders is a massive thing. I wrote a whole book about it because getting the right breeder is like just everything. And in fact, just before I came on to record, I had a message of someone who was interested in one of my pups. And I said to her, "Oh, you kind of you good? I'll get in touch when I'm ready to breed." And I had planned to breed from Mizzle, my youngest, but I got the news earlier on this year. Unfortunately, she's got a grade 2 heart murmur. All the rest of the litter are fine. She has a grade 2 heart murmur, so of course I'm not going to be breeding from her. She messaged me and I said, "I'm really sorry. I can point you in other directions, but I'm not going to be breeding from her. And until I buy a bitch in or and use Moss's frozen sperm or whatever, then it's not happening." And her response was, which is exactly the right response that you want, was, "Oh, that makes me want a puppy off you more because you're being responsible." And it's nice. It's nice.
This is firstly, I totally agree. Like, the breeder thing, I think, is the most important decision you'll actually make. Like, it's more important than the training you do is actually the dog that you get in the first place, whether it's even the right breed for you, like at the most basic. And then beyond that, like, which breeder you go to is like way more important than people realize. Yeah, it's extremely important. It's one of the reasons I like my breeder as well, because, it's funny. He breeds a lot of dogs. He's also ridiculously honest about his dogs. I remember the first time I visited him in Germany, and I was supposed to be getting a dog from one of his litters. And the male of the pair was more his wife's dog than his dog. And he probably spent an hour telling me why he didn't like that dog. And I was like, you realize I'm here to pick up a puppy from this dog that you're telling me you don't like? And anyway, big surprise, I didn't get a dog from that litter. But like, yeah, it's funny. Like, he's very, very honest. Like to the point where it's like kind of jarring, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, but you want that because there's so many breeders that only I've heard so many stories from people breeders that have only told them the good things, right? Or like there are issues with the dogs, like health issues, etc., that they've had to find out from third parties, etc. Like, because people don't want to, they only want to tell you the positives. And that's a real shame. And it is it's a shame people can't be open about it as well, because part of dog breeding and part of understanding the genetic diversity side of things is like, not every dog has to be perfect.
No.
Because really the perfect dog doesn't really exist.
No.
So there's always going to be like pros and cons of the dogs, you know, like, hey, you know, I don't quite like this quality about the dog, but they have these other qualities that are really good. And that's part of like the skill of pairing dogs as well.
Yep. So their qualities and less than qualities are complemented, and you hope for the best, and you're always aiming for perfection, but it's an ongoing process. It's not in one generation you're going to get perfection. It doesn't work like that.
There's this pressure on breeders to like think, to have this illusion of like every dog that they breed is like perfect, and it's like that just doesn't exist.
No,
so I would much rather go to a breeder that actually tells me, hey, this is what I like about the dog, this is what I don't like about the dog, but this is why I'm breeding them to this dog, because I think that this is going to counteract this. Like when I went over this most recent time, Hans, because I picked up this dog, Hans was going through the whole pedigree with me. It's really, really cool, and he was showing me videos of like the granddad and what, you know, like show me like going back in the pedigree. And he's like, hey, this dog had my current dog's granddad is called Sid, and he was really, really like a really good dog, but he had one bad thing. I probably shouldn't be saying this on the podcast. He had one bad thing where maybe his jumping, like he had issues with jumping, like he'd be hesitant jumping sometimes. So Hans like, hey, so this is what I bred him to this dog. This dog had amazing jumping. And, you know, like, so, like, there's, like, it's all factored in, you know? Yeah. Like, this is the reality of dog breeding, but there's this weird pressure for everything to be perfect, and then people aren't honest for that reason.
Yeah. I think it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in some ways, that people some breeders set out with the best intentions. They'll get all the health tests done. They will, you know, put the best two dogs that they can find together, have the puppies. And at some point down the line, there is going to be something that goes wrong, even with the best intentions. One of those dogs is not going to be well, going to come up with something weird, because that's genetics. That's just the way it works. But they feel like they have to hide that from the world because, you know, they don't want to admit that they got it wrong. And it's not necessarily that they got it wrong. It's just the fact that that's how genetics work. There is genetic variety. There is things that are going to come up from 5, 6 generations ago, or just an anomaly is going to happen. But people then start to hide it, and then people think, oh, well, they're the best breeder ever. And then, you know, it comes this vicious cycle, and then they're almost, the breeder convinces themselves they have the best dogs. They just compartmentalize the ones that aren't. And it's one of my big bugbears.
It's a shame. I wish people could be more open about the things that they don't like about their dogs, you know. Yeah. And then they can explain why they're making the decisions they're making to try to mitigate that or whatever. You know, like, I feel like oftentimes people feel like they can only tell you the things that they do like.
Mm.
And then they just kind of like sweep the rest under the blanket and it's under the carpet. So it's just like, yeah, it's a shame.
It's not,
but that's
good.
Just,
I mean,
like, life, right?
Yeah.
It's not even just breeding dogs. It's just like, that's...
It's social media, yeah. Isn't it? Let's put all the good things on. Yep, totally. Yeah,
exactly. It's everything.
But we'll wrap it up in a minute. But I just wanted to say that when Moss was younger, he was a stud dog. And, you know, I think he's sired 4 or 5 litters off the top of my head. But I had a lot more inquiries about him than that. And quite often what I'd get was a message that was like, oh, I've got my bitch and they're about to be in season or just in season. Can I use your boy? And I'd be like, why are you breeding? And that just that question alone put so many people off, you know, that I wouldn't get a response. But it's like, yes, okay, you're going to come and offer me some money, for the use of my dog, but I'm not going to take that money and not know what the purpose is. You've not come and met the dog, and you know, the dogs may not be compatible or may not be the best choice. You're just looking at it as, you know, a pumping machine, for want of a better term, when actually that's going to be half of those puppies. And yeah, anyway, because I could go on and
it's a big problem. It's not even just dog breeding. Like, dog breeding is like the least of it in some ways, because it's the same with puppy buying. Like, I know, I speak to dog trainers, not even dog owners. I speak to dog trainers that get dogs like from petsforhomes.com, you know, like, oh, no, Rottweiler, I want a whatever, and they just type in the breed, and they're just like looking for like local breeders, and it's like, you should know better than this. Yep. You know.
Yeah.
I know I'm extreme going to Germany. The way I factor it in is like, I'm gonna have the dog for 12 years. Like, what is a couple of days driving to Germany?
Oh, I'm totally with you on that one. But yeah, most people won't even drive another 20 miles.
Yeah, exactly. But you don't have to go to that extreme. Quid. You don't have to go to that extreme. Yeah, go like, find the best breeder in the UK if you're in the UK or whatever. Or like you said, I mean, nowadays there are even courier services. Like, you can pay someone £200-300 and they bring the dog to you, like, if you hate traveling. So there are options way beyond just like, oh, I'm just going to go to the most local breeder. And then, you know, people aren't looking at health scores. They're not looking at COI scores. Like, people just aren't aware of any of this stuff, and then that goes into, we talk about the dog breeding world, people just don't care about COI or anything like that. The only thing they care about is like popular studs. It's like, oh, he's produced this champion in this or whatever, and you know,
you, when using a popular dogs, stud actually makes the whole problem worse.
Yeah, they get these dogs that have been used like over 100 times, you know. It's like, and that's just normalized, and no one thinks that that's a negative thing. And it's like, and by the way, when I talk about this, I've done podcasts where we talk about this, and then the comment section will be people having a go at me like, hey, what do I know? It's like, it's madness to me. It's like, this isn't an original thought. Go read the geneticists. And people will say, hey, go talk to the dog breeders. It's like, yeah, but they're causing the problem. Go talk to the geneticists that actually really know about this, because the dog breeders aren't thinking about these problems. And you can tell this, just go look at other breeds, go look at Dobermans, go look at Great Danes. These dogs that are like not living long at all and are like riddled with issues. And a lot of breeds are having issues because of, you know, the insistence we have on purity and like the new idea about what a pedigree dog is. Yeah, we could talk about this for a long, long time. This is actually the idea of a pedigree dog even is actually way more modern than people think.
So, I think we're going to stop it there, because...
Yeah, do you want to make a 3-hour podcast?
not today, but I reckon we really could go into a proper one about all of that, because, yeah, it sounds like it's both of our bags to rant on about. But yes, anyway, so thank you very much. Can you share with the listeners, you know, how they can find you, what you offer, the name of your podcast again, all of that kind of shizzle, please?
Yeah, so I don't want to overwhelm people with information, but I think in terms of the neutrality stuff we've been speaking about today, I did want to make a fancy link for today, but I didn't have time. So probably the best thing
for people to do is... Send it for the show notes.
Okay, super. Best thing for people to do is just find me on social media. If we get a link in the show notes, obviously you can look for that. I'm sure I'm going to be posting about it and posting the links there. See, if you just type in my name, Nick Benger, you're going to find me on social media. I do have a podcast called Dog Talk with Nick Benger. So I actually have a interesting podcast coming out as well with my friend Alex Latto, which is going to be called Dogs in Discourse, which will be on YouTube. I'm just hassling Alex to get the editing done, so you can find us there as well. But yeah, thanks for having me, Sarah.
No, it might be my pleasure. In fact, we've kind of like touched on so many different topics, and I've loved it. I really have. But yes, thank you very much for joining me, Nick. And thank you to the listeners, and I will be back next week.
I wanted to take a second to make you an offer to join my membership. This is on WhatsApp, and you get weekly videos of things to work on, new themes each month, 2 turbo training calls a week where we all train together on WhatsApp and work on what you want to get that progress and accountability, monthly catch-up calls, and so much more. Ideal for if you get a bit stuck or you keep putting off the training with your dog, and absolutely perfect if you're on your journey into dog sports too. We're currently celebrating 1 whole year of the Maven crew, and as part of that, I am offering you, my wonderful listener, the chance to get in and try it out for free for a whole month. Drop me a message on socials or email me, sarah@multidogmaven.co.uk. That's sarah@multidogmaven.co.uk, and get the link to get in. Don't be shy. Reach out. I would love to hear from you. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dog Gone Wrong podcast. If you could do me a quick favour, like or follow the pod, rate and leave a review, and maybe share with a dog-owning friend. Let's get the word out there and ensure there is less guilt around the mistakes. Thank you again, and we'll be back next week.